bid to keep Leah for a series of overnight visits under Janine's supervision. Blood tests show that they had administered adequate levels of Depakine. In the petition CPS filed at Leah's 12-month reunification hearing, Janine Hilt wrote, "As the Lees' skill increased, the visits were extended. The undersigned provided extensive supervision 3 times daily while the minor was in the home. Supervision decreased as the Lees demonstrated their willingness to maintain the medication regime. The undersigned has worked with the Lees on maintaining a daily schedule, including proper diet, naps, and discipline. Mr. and Mrs. Lee are to be commended for their cooperation and positive efforts in working with the undersigned in spite of their divergent cultural beliefs. As a result of their hard work, trust in the physician, neurologist Terry Hutchinson, and the undersigned, we have made incredible headway in resolving Leah's serious medical problem." Leah returned home on April 30th, 1986. Chapter 8. Phua and Nakao. In 1988, during my first few weeks in Merced, 7 doctors at the Merced Community Medical Center separately mentioned the case of Leah Lee to me, but each of them told me it was not worth investigating because her parents mistrusted Americans and would almost certainly refuse to let me see Leah's medical and legal records or to talk with me themselves. Even if they agreed to meet me, I was assured that I would find them silent, obtuse, and almost pathologically lacking in effect. I was ready to be discouraged. Before I came to Merced, I had never met a Hmong, but I had received plenty of advice from anthropologists I'd read or consulted on what to do when I did. Don't raise your voice. Take off your shoes. Don't offer to shake hands with a man, or people will think you're a whore. If a man offers to shake hands with you, indicate your lower status by placing your left hand under your right wrist in order to support the weight of his honored and important hand. If you walk with a Hmong leader, stay behind him and to his left. Use an older male interpreter to compensate for your lack of status as a younger woman. Don't ever say no to an offer of food, even if it's chicken feet. It did not seem a promising sign that my friend Bill Selvage, the doctor who had invited me to Merced to meet his Hmong patients, had bookshelves jammed with ethnographic monographs on the Ik, the Tkung, and the Palawans, but during his 2 years in Merced had never had an extended conversation with a Hmong over the age of 14, had never been invited inside a Hmong home, and had learned only one word of Hmong. Ma, it hurts. If an anthropologically inclined Peace Corps veteran had made so little headway, how could I expect to get anywhere myself? Indeed, my first few Hmong encounters proved disastrous. It probably did not help that, mortally afraid of committing a faux pas, I was as jumpy as the legendary Hmong princess who, hiding inside a large funeral drum after an eagle as big as 11 houses had eaten everyone else in her village, mistook her handsome young rescuer for the eagle and told him, "If you have come to eat me, do it quickly, please." Then she fainted. Later, however, she married him. My first meetings with Hmong families were set up by a Hmong-speaking lowland Lao woman who worked as a nurse's aide at MCMC. It did not immediately occur to me that I had found the best possible way to guarantee myself a chilly reception, since almost all Hmong mistrusted the hospital, and, concluding that I was associated with the nurse's aide, and therefore with MCMC, automatically mistrusted me, too. I also had bad luck with my first 2 interpreters. Carefully following my advisor's instructions, I asked 2 middle-aged men in turn, each an important figure in his clan, to translate for me. My experiences with them were identical. I would ask a question, the interpreter would translate. The Hmong I was questioning would talk animatedly to the interpreter for 4 or 5 minutes. Then the interpreter would turn to me and say, "He says no." I was beginning to fear that the Hmong community was impenetrable when I met Suki Waller, the psychologist at Merced Community Outreach Services, whom one doctor at MCMC had described as a sort of hippie-ish revolutionary, and Bill had described as the American most locally respected by the Hmong. I had talked with Suki by phone from New York City before I came to Merced. She had told me, "Here's my home phone number. If you get my answering machine, you will find I speak so slowly it sounds as if I'm in the middle of a terrible depression or on drugs. Please don't be alarmed. It's just that I get a lot of calls from clients who don't understand fast English." Suki's business card read in Hmong and Lao, "Fixer of Hearts." She explained to me, "Psychological problems do not exist for the Hmong because they do not distinguish between mental and physical illness. Everything is a spiritual problem. It's not really possible to translate what I do into Hmong. A shaman is the closest person to a psychotherapist, but fixing hearts was the best metaphor I could find. The only danger is that they might think I do open-heart surgery. That would certainly make them run in the other direction." Suki introduced me to 5 Hmong leaders representing 4 of the most influential of Merced's 14 clans, and because I arrived at their homes and offices in her company, I was warmly received by each one. 2 of them became irreplaceable sources and, over time, valued friends. When I asked Suki why the Hmong community accepted her so readily, she said, "The Hmong and I have a lot in common. I have an anarchist subpersonality. I don't like coercion. I also believe that the long way around is often the shortest way from point A to point B. And I'm not very interested in what is generally called the truth. In my opinion, consensual reality is better than facts." Suki quickly disabused me of 2 notions. One was that it was necessary to walk a razor's edge of proper etiquette on either side of which lay catastrophe. She said matter-of-factly, "I've made a million errors. When I came here, everyone said, 'You can't touch people on the head. You can't talk to a man. You can't do this. You can't do that.' And finally, I said, 'This is crazy. I can't be restricted like that.' So I just threw it all out. Now, I have only one rule. Before I do anything, I ask, 'Is it okay?' Because I'm an American woman and they don't expect me to act like a Hmong anyway. They usually give me plenty of leeway." She also punctured my burgeoning longing for an American interpreter. For one thing, she informed me that even though there were thousands of Hmong living in Merced, not a single American in town spoke Hmong. For another, in her opinion, someone who merely converted Hmong words into English, however accurately, would be of no help to me whatsoever. "I don't call my staff interpreters," she told me. "I call them cultural brokers. They teach me. When I don't know what to do, I ask them. You should go find yourself a cultural broker." So I found Mei Ying Zhang. Mei Ying was a 20-year-old clerk typist at the Merced County Office of Refugee Services. Her name means opium poppy. She was the girl whose father, Cha Li Zhang, afraid that she would be eaten by lions if she took a summer job with the Youth Conservation Corps, had occasioned Dan Murphy's lion scouting trip to Yosemite. Cha Li, who died in 1983, was the first lieutenant in the Royal Lao Army, one of the few Hmong military officers who had been trained in the United States by the CIA. He was also a famous Zineng, who, while riding his wooden shaman's bench, an embodiment of the winged horse that carried him in search of wandering souls, was renowned for shaking so hard during his ritual trance that it took 2 assistants to hold him. To complete Mei Ying's distinguished resume, she had at age 18 been second runner-up in the National Miss Hmong pageant held annually in the Fresno Civic Auditorium, in which she had worn three formal costumes, one Hmong, one Lao, one American, and been judged on her poise, grace, beauty, and speaking ability. When asked, "If you were chosen to be Miss Hmong, what would you do to set an example for future young Hmong ladies?" Mei Ying had answered, "I would encourage children to go to school and young ladies not to get married too young." 1 month later, she married an engineering student named Peng Li in a Hmong American ceremony that involved the sacrifice of a chicken and the consumption of many bottles of Löwenbräu. Mei Ying took great pride in the fact that Peng had paid her family the unusually high bride price of $1,800. She in turn had contributed a dowry that consisted of a trust fund left by her father, a silver necklace, a silver belt, gold earrings, three embroidered skirts, two formal Hmong costumes, two pieces of embroidery embellished with antique French colonial coins, and a 73 Ford Granada. Despite the admonitions of the seven doctors, I decided to try to meet Leah's parents, bringing Mei Ying as my cultural broker. I figured that if she was the third most poised Hmong woman in the United States, she had as good a chance as anyone of being able to deal with the Lees. Despite Mei Ying's impressive qualifications, she and I, by virtue of our gender and ages, constituted a decidedly low-status team. That turned out to be an advantage. I didn't need more status in the Lee home. If anything, I needed less status. Ever since they arrived in the United States, the Lees had been meeting Americans who, whether because of their education, their knowledge of English, or their positions of relative authority, had made them feel as if their family didn't count for much. Being belittled is the one thing no Hmong can bear. When Laos was under French colonial rule, the Hmong were required literally to crawl whenever they were in the presence of a Lao official, forbidden to raise their heads until they were acknowledged. It is no accident that in one particular Hmong folktale, an arrogant official is turned into a mouse upon which the tale's hero, a Hmong archetype in the guise of a cat, takes delight in pouncing. With Mei Ying at my side, I was not an official, not a threat, not a critic, not a person who was trying to persuade the Lees to do anything they did not wish to do, not even someone to be taken very seriously. My insignificance was my saving grace. Meeting a Hmong is like getting into a speakeasy. Everything depends on who sent you. My appointment with the Lees had been arranged by Bli Yao Muo, one of the Hmong leaders to whom Suki had introduced me, a man fortuitously unconnected to the hospital or any other American institution. What's more, Mei Ying's husband, Peng, belonged to the same clan as the Lees. Li and Li are differently spelled Americanizations of the Hmong surname Li, which led Fo and Nakao to treat my cultural broker like a long-lost niece. Within 30 seconds, I could see I was dealing with a family that bore little resemblance to the one the doctors had described. The Lees struck me as smart, humorous, talkative, and energetic. I wish I could say that it was my skill as an interviewer that brought out these excellent qualities. In truth, I repeatedly embarrassed Mei Ying by asking her to translate questions of such surpassing ignorance that after I got to know the Lees, I began to feel my primary role in their household was as a source of mirth. Mei Ying referred to these questions. "Did you bury your children's placentas? In Laos, were there a lot of das who lived in the rivers, lakes, and trees? Do you sacrifice pigs? Is the Pope Catholic?" Questions, because any fool would know the answers were yes. Once, when I asked in which part of their house in Laos the family had relieved themselves, Fo laughed so hard she almost fell off her bamboo stool. "In the forest, of course," she finally gasped, tears running down her cheeks. The Lees were a good-looking couple. Four looked about 45 and Akau about 10 years older. They had never learned their birth dates. They were both short, and although neither was fat, they looked well-rooted, as if it would take a gale-force wind or maybe even an earthquake to knock them over. Foy had glossy black hair that she usually wore in a bun, but sometimes she loosened it absent-mindedly while she was talking, and it unfurled to her waist. Nakao wore glasses with thick black frames that made him look intellectual and a little nerdy, like a teacher of an obscure branch of mathematics at a minor college. Except on special occasions, when they wore monk clothes, they both wore loosely fitting American outfits of pastel polyester. Sometimes Fo wore a long gray cotton skirt and a pink t-shirt decorated with palm trees that said, California. A word, of course, she could not read. When I first met Fo and Nakao, they had 7 children still at home. The 9 of them lived in a 3-room apartment in a 2-story stucco building south of the train tracks and west of the Kmart, in a down-at-heel neighborhood that 20 years ago was mostly Hispanic and now is mostly Hmong. Like most Hmong apartments, it contained hardly any furniture aside from a television set, which was usually on. There was no books. Hung close to the ceiling, to show respect, was a heterogeneous collection of family photographs and posters, including an outdated calendar from a Thai rice company, a Time Life illustrated chart of combat jets of the world, and a picture of several dozen Smurfs gathered around a campfire. The bedroom shared by the older children was plastered with posters of U2, Bon Jovi, Whitesnake, and Motley Crue. The family's most prized possession, a 3-foot-long bamboo qing that only Nakao knew how to play, was carefully mounted over the toilet. The most important part of the Lee home was the parking lot. It was there, in an overflowing collection of dozens of old 5-gallon plastic buckets and discarded motor oil cans, that Fo cultivated her personal pharmacopoeia of medical plants which, boiled or ground in her mortar and pestle, were used to cure sore throats, stomach aches, sprained limbs, and postpartum pain, among other ailments. I was to spend hundreds of hours in this apartment, usually in the evenings, after Mei Ying got off work. Because Fo and Nakao could not read or write in any language, they were excessively interested in and therefore inhibited by note-taking, but they were entirely comfortable with a tape recorder. Most Hmong in Merced communicated with relatives in Thai refugee camps via audio cassette. I could never decide whether this was incongruously high-tech or whether it was an organic extension of their pre-literate oral tradition. When addressing Fo, Mei Ying prefaced each question with the word Ba, a title connoting both respect and intimacy that means, literally, paternal grandmother. After a few months, Fo started to address Mei Ying as Mi Mai, dear little Mei, and me as Mi An. At about the same time, at their request, I started calling Fo Thai, maternal grandmother, and Nakao Yotzi, maternal grandfather. The Lees unhesitatingly granted me access to all of Leah's records at MCMC, Valley Children's Hospital in Fresno, and the Merced County Health Department, and Child Protective Services. After I read them, however, I quickly learned that it was not helpful to ask Mei Ying to relay such questions as, "Can you tell me about the time Dr. Selvage admitted Leah to MCMC with right upper lobe pneumonia on June 28, 1986 at 10:50 p.m?" The doctors' diagnoses were untranslatable, and in any case, they would have meant little to the Lees. Furthermore, Fo and Nakao lumped the dozens of healthcare providers they had encountered at MCMC under the generic heading of Leah's doctors. Even Neil Ernst and Peggy Philp, who had met Leah's family innumerable times, were relegated by their unshakably high status, and also perhaps from a Hmong point of view, by their unpronounceability, to a category too distant to allow such intimacies as being called by name. The difficulty of establishing a parallel chronology between Leah's medical chart and her family's experience of her illness was compounded by the fact that the Lees did not tell time in the way that the hospital record keepers did. Years were identified not by number, but by salient event. For instance, 1982 was the year the spirit first caught Leah and she fell down. 1985 was the year Leah became government property. When they had lived in Laos, the Lees, like other Hmong, had subdivided the year not by the months of the Gregorian calendar, but by the lunar cycles designated by their primary agricultural activities. The first cycle, for example, which followed the Hmong New Year celebration in late November or early December, was the one during which rice and corn were hauled home and the opium harvest was begun. The fifth cycle was the one during which corn was planted. The 12th cycle was the one during which rice was harvested and opium was weeded. Because the Lees were now unemployed welfare recipients rather than farmers, and each month's activities, or their lack, were nearly identical to every other month's, they no longer oriented themselves by the Hmong calendar, and consequently often had trouble remembering when, even in what season, an event had occurred. But when they referred to times of the day, they continued to use the Hmong phrases. First cock crow, second cock crow, time that the sun inclines, time that the shadows cover the valley, pig feeding time, full darkness. Even though no cocks or pigs had lived on East 12th Street within living memory of any resident of Merced. The Lees politely submitted to my questions about Leah, often answering at length, but they also had their own agenda, which, as Nakao once put it, was to tell you about Hmong culture so you can understand our way and explain it to the doctors. Their favorite time for these cultural lessons was about 10:30 p.m., after they'd gathered conversational steam for at least 4 hours. One night, just as Mei Ying and I were getting ready to leave, Fu decided to explain soul loss to me. "Your soul is like your shadow," she said. "Sometimes it just wanders off like a butterfly, and that is when you are sad, and that's when you get sick. And if it comes back to you, that is when you are happy and you are well again." Nakao added, "Sometimes the soul goes away, but the doctors don't believe it. I would like you to tell the doctors to believe in our Neng. The word for Neng, or healing spirit, is often used as shorthand for Onengka, the shamanic ritual performed by a Tzineng, in which an animal is sacrificed and its soul bartered for the vagrant soul of a sick person. The doctors can fix some sickness that involve the body and blood, but for us, Hmong, some people get sick because of their soul, so they need spiritual things. With Leah, it was good to do a little medicine and a little Neng, but not too much medicine, because the medicine cuts the Neng's effect. If we did a little of each, she didn't get sick as much. But the doctors wouldn't let us give just a little medicine because they didn't understand about the soul." On another late night occasion, Nakao explained that the Hmong often got sick because of their encounters with malevolent Das, but that the doctors didn't understand this either and therefore failed to treat these patients effectively. "I will give you an example," he said. "There is a man named Mr. Zhang, and he has a son who went to swim at Bear Creek. Bear Creek is a small muddy river that flows through Applegate Park, north of downtown Merced. And while Mr. Zhang's son was sleeping, the dad that lives in Bear Creek came up to him and talked to him and made him sick and restless and crazy. The doctors and nurses in Merced gave this young man shots and medicines, and the young man hated the doctors and nurses, because the only way to cure that kind of sickness is to sacrifice a dog. and this country won't allow you to kill dogs. Fua told me that a Da had caught her just the previous week at the county reservoir. She knew this had happened because after she returned home, she felt afraid, and when she closed her eyes, she could sense that a Da was near. She left all the lights on that night to frighten the Da away, and she did not become sick. Several months later, I was to learn that Merced's Das were not confined to natural surroundings. Chong Muo, a Hmong woman who cleaned Bill Selvage's house once a week, told me that every Hmong in town knew about the Da who lived at the intersection of Highway 99 and G Street. This Da liked to cause accidents by making Hmong drivers fall asleep or making the cars of approaching Americans invisible. The longer I spent with the Lees, the more firmly Fua took me in hand. She improved my manners by teaching me, via Mei Ying, how to say please and thank you in Hmong. When she learned that I occasionally got headaches, she gave me detailed instructions on how to treat them by rubbing an egg-covered coin up and down my body. I think she was disappointed that I never actually contracted a headache on her premises so that she could heal it then and there. "But you remember," she said, "next time you do it the way I said." When Fo had known me for almost a year, she decided to get me married. The Hmong have a phrase, "a flower full of honey and ready for the bee," which is used to describe a marriageable girl of 15 or 16. I was 35 and had thus been ready for the bee for 2 decades. When my boyfriend visited me in Merced, Fo realized that she had finally had an opportunity to do something about this appalling situation. Her plan, of which she did not inform me in advance, was to dress me as a Hmong bride, a transformation she was certain would render me irresistible. My makeover took place on a sweltering summer day. The temperature in Lise's bedroom must have been well over 100 degrees. Out of a battered suitcase that she kept in the back of her closet, Fua extracted piece after piece of exquisite ban dao. Ban dao, which means flower cloth, is a traditional Hmong textile art in which geometric or organic designs, spider webs, rams' heads, tigers' eyebrows, elephants' feet, are worked in embroidery, batik, applique, and reverse applique. In Laos, a Hmong man was said to value 2 qualities most highly in a wife: her ability to sing poetry and her skill at ban dao. Fo had made these clothes for her daughters. They constituted the lion's share of the family's wealth. Assisted by her 14-year-old daughter, Mei, the oldest Li girl still living at home, and by Mei Ying Zhang, Fo dressed me like a doll. I was completely at their mercy since I had no idea which garment was coming next and when it came, what part of my body it was supposed to adorn. First, Fua picked up a po, a pink and black sash at least 20 feet long, and wound it around me like a ribbon around a maypole. Its function was the precise opposite of a girdle's. It was supposed to fatten me up, to transform me into a healthy Hmong farm wife who looked capable of carrying heavy loads of rice. Then came the tia, a pink, green, and yellow skirt with about 500 accordion pleats, which, if it had been spread out, would have been wider than I was tall. Its cross-stitching was so fine it looked like beading. Mei Ying told me later that it had probably taken Fua the better part of 2 years to make and that it would take her several hours to restitch threads through each of its pleats to prepare it again for storage. Over that went a pink brocade she, a kind of apron whose ban dao work was protected by an American refinement, a layer of plastic wrap. On my upper half, I wore a blue and black jacket called a cha, the same word as the Hmong term for placenta, one's first garment, and 4 na cha pocket-like bags decorated with dangling silver coins, which were hung bandolier-style across my chest and weighed a ton. Around my neck went a 5-tier necklace of hollow silver. Around my calves, Mei Ying wrapped a pair of black putties called chong. And on my head, four balanced the pièce de résistance, a gomo, a pink, green, and yellow hat, bedizened with its own set of silver coins that was shaped like a pagoda and jingled whenever I moved. Although I nearly died of heat prostration during the 45 minutes it took Four, Mei, and Mei Ying to wrestle all this stuff onto me, I felt for the first time in my not very fashionable adulthood that I understood the ritual pleasure of women gussying each other up and giggling like crazy in rooms to which men were forbidden entrance. While all this was taking place, my friend George was sitting in the air-conditioned living room watching a boxing match on television with Nakao and wondering what I was doing. Neither he nor Nakao spoke a word of each other's language, but they communicated in the universal language of male bonding by throwing punches in the air and making appreciative grunts. When I emerged from the bedroom, George was, in a word, stunned. He didn't think I looked good, exactly. He told me later that I resembled Tom Kitten in the Roly-Poly Pudding, after Mrs. Whiskers ties him up and covers him with pie dough. However, Fu's work must in some way have had the intended effect, because a week later, George asked me to marry him. When we told Fu that we were engaged, she didn't act in the least surprised. Later, when I complimented Fu on her beautiful needlework, she said matter-of-factly, "Yes, my friends are proud of me because of my pandao. The Hmong are proud of me." That is the only time I ever heard her say anything kind about herself. She was otherwise the most self-deprecating woman I had ever met. One night, when Nakao was out for the evening, she remarked, out of the blue, "I am very stupid." When I asked her why, she said, "Because I don't know anything here. I don't know your language. American is so hard. You can watch TV all day and you still don't know it. I can't dial the telephone because I can't read the numbers. If I want to call a friend, my children will tell me and I will forget, and the children will tell me again and I will forget again. My children go to the store to buy food because I don't know what is in the packages. One time when I went to the hospital, I went to the bathroom, and the hall went that way and that way and that way and that way, and I didn't know which way to go. And I couldn't get back to where I was because too many sad things have happened to me, and my brain is not good anymore." When I suggested that I would have had at least as much trouble finding my way around her village in Laos as she had finding her way around MCMC, Fu said, "Maybe, but in Laos it was easy. I didn't know how to do anything but farm." Venturing that it couldn't have been quite so easy as she claimed, I asked her to describe a typical day in Hoi Soi, the village in the northwestern province of Saiburi, where the Lee family had lived. She tilted her head to one side for a moment, thinking. Then she said, "In the season when you have to tend the rice fields, you get up at first cockcrow. In the other seasons, you can wake up at second or third cockcrow. Even at third cockcrow, it is before dawn, and it is dark. So the first thing you do is light a lamp." The lamp was like this. Fu walked into the kitchen and came back holding the bottom three quarters of a Mountain Dew can, which was filled with oil and had a homemade cloth wick. "In Merced, when the electricity goes out, we still use one like this," she said. "First, you cook the rice for your children," she continued. "Then you clean the house with the broom you tie together yourself. After you are finished sweeping, you go and cut wild grasses to give to the pigs, and you cut more for the cows, and you feed the pigs and the cows and the chickens. Then you walk to the fields. You carry the baby on your back, and if you have two children, your husband carries one on his back too. And if you have a lot of children, you can leave some of the smaller ones at home with the big ones. Our parents grew opium, but we just grew rice and also peppers, corn, and cucumbers. When it is planting time, first you make a hole in the ground, like this. She walked back to the kitchen, and after rummaging around for something with which to demonstrate to me the use of a dibble stick, she returned with a cardboard tube that had once held a roll of paper towels, which she proceeded to stab at 1-foot intervals into her living room's brown wall-to-wall carpeting. Like this. Then you put the seeds in the holes. You and your husband do it together. In other seasons, you clear the fields and harvest the rice and thresh and winnow the rice and grind the corn. At this point in her narrative, her daughter May walked in wearing shorts, a t-shirt that said, "Time for the beach," and pink plastic earrings. May was 3 and a half when her family left Laos. She sat on the carpet at her mother's feet and listened. "The farm place was far from where we lived," said Fu, "farther than from here to Bear Creek. If you leave the farm when it is still light, it is dark by the time you get home. When you get home, you go to the stream and carry the water for cooking and bathing in a barrel on your back." Fu showed me how she had made the pack barrel, gesturing with her fingers to illustrate how the bamboo was wrapped around the wooden staves. "You bathe the babies by boiling the water, and then you pour it into the smaller bowl. The older children can bathe themselves. You bring corn for the chickens and you feed the pigs, and then you cook for your family. We usually just ate leftover rice from our first meal, with a little vegetables, because we ate meat only about once a month. You cook on the hot coals of the fire, and you use the fat from the last pig you killed to fry with. The smoke just goes through the spaces in the roof. After dinner, you sew by the light of that lamp. In the fields, you wear clothes that are old and dirty and ripped up, but the children have to have good clothes for New Year's, so you sew for them at night." I asked Fu to describe their house. "It is made of wood from the forest," she said. "Some wood as big as telephone poles. The thatching is bamboo. I helped build it. Our relatives helped us too, and then we help our relatives when they need a house. Our house is all one room, but it is very nice. The floor is earth. If you want to sleep, you take some bamboo. You cut it open and split into small pieces and they are springy and you make it into a bed. We sleep next to the fireplace where it is warm because we don't have any blankets. My husband sleeps on one side holding a baby. I sleep on the other side holding another baby and the other children keep each other warm." While Fu was telling me about the dozens of tasks that constituted her easy work in Laos, I was thinking that when she said she was stupid, what she really meant was that none of her former skills were transferable to the United States. None, that is, except for being an excellent mother to her 9 surviving children. It then occurred to me that this last skill had been officially contradicted by the American government, which had legally declared her a child abuser. I asked Fu if she missed Laos. She was silent for a few seconds, rocking back and forth on her low bamboo stool while her daughter looked at her, waiting curiously for her answer. Then she said, "When you think about Laos and about not having enough food and those dirty and torn up clothes, you don't want to think. Here it is a great country. You are comfortable. You have something to eat. But you don't speak the language. You depend on other people for welfare. If they don't give you money, you can't eat, and you would die of hunger. What I miss in Laos is that free spirit, doing what you want to do. You own your own fields, your own rice, your own plants, your own fruit trees. I miss that feeling of freeness. I miss having something that really belongs to me." Chapter 9. A Little Medicine and a Little Ning. When Leah came back, recalled Nicole, the car came up here, and when the door opened, she just jumped up and ran into her home. Her sisters and brother were too happy to even do anything. Everyone just went out and hugged her. That night, she was in our bed, and we were so happy to have her sleeping by our side. Looking over Leah's sparse medical records from the spring and summer of 1986, around the time of her fourth birthday, Peggy Philp summed up the first few months after her return from foster care in three words. Nothing interesting here. The Lees would disagree. Neil and Peggy had previously spent hours recounting the details of medically complex periods in Leah's history that Foa and Nakao had summarized for me in a few minutes. Now the tables were turned, and a period that seemed uneventful from the doctor's perspective was revealed, from the Lees' perspective, to be one of the richest in her life. The first thing Foa and Nakao did after Leah returned was to celebrate her homecoming and bolster her health by sacrificing a cow. In Laos, most of the chickens, pigs, cows, and buffaloes kept by Hmong families were reserved for sacrifices to propitiate ancestors or cure illnesses by offering the souls of the slaughtered animals as ransom for fugitive souls. Even families too poor to keep animals of their own were guaranteed occasional meat in their diets by being invited to Ning ceremonies performed by wealthier villagers. According to Dwight Conkergood, sacrifice is a sacred act performed with respect and reverence. He has written, "The souls of sacrificed animals are precious and vitally connected to human souls. Animals are not considered to be as far removed from the human species as they are in our worldview. Since the bonding between the life souls of the patient and sacrificed animal is so intimate, it is likened to souls being wedded together." Eric Crystal, the coordinator of the Center for Southeast Asia Studies at UC Berkeley, takes an equally approbatory, if not quite so high-minded view.
"So what if some Hmong feel that they have to slaughter animals to make the proper kinds of sacrifices?" he asked me rhetorically. "Why not? It happens because people usually mark religious events that are important to them by getting together with relatives. And it is very difficult in this world to get a whole bunch of relatives together, whether you are living in some village in Laos or in Manhattan, without giving them something to eat. So you sacralize the event. The whole animal is offered, and the whole animal is eaten. I mean the whole animal, 98% of it, intestines and everything, in a very ecologically sound way. Americans toss away a huge amount of meat. We also kind of slip it under the rug that people actually have to kill animals to eat them. Indeed, it may be shocking to many Americans to find out that their $1.99 a pound chicken breast actually had to get its throat cut in a processing plant. So Americans are real shocked if they find out that the Hmong are doing it right in their own houses." During the last decade, shocked Americans have responded to the ritual killings performed by devotees of other religions by invoking legal sanctions. In Hialeah, Florida, animal rights activists and community leaders passed an anti-sacrifice ordinance in 1987 to prevent priests of the Afro-Cuban Santeria faith from slaughtering animals, a practice one local resident said blights the image of South Florida. The ban was overturned, but it took 4 years and a Supreme Court decision. In Los Angeles, where followers of Santeria and several other Hispanic sects were suspected of nailing cows' tongues to trees and leaving entrails on sidewalks, an ordinance was passed in 1990 that made animal sacrifice punishable by a 6-month prison term and a fine of up to $1,000. It is still on the books, though it is not currently being enforced. In Merced, almost every Hmong family I met sacrificed animals on a regular basis. In fact, a 14-year-old boy I knew, a member of the Moa clan, once complained
that he hardly ever had enough free time on weekends because his parents made him attend so many of his relatives' Ning ceremonies. Until the mid-90s, however, most American residents of Merced had little idea what was going on, and no one seemed concerned that it might blight the image of Central California.
"Well, I haven't run into any sacrificial chickens," Pat Lunny, the chief of police, told me with some amusement several years ago.
"Sacrifices," said Steve Nord, the city attorney. "Do they really do that?"
The Hmong have a phrase, "yuo bai guo," which means that the truth will eventually come to light. Literally, it means feces will be excreted. I knew it was only a matter of time before feces would be excreted on the subject of Hmong animal sacrifices. And indeed, in 1996, tipped off by a local newspaper coverage of a dog sacrifice in Fresno, the residents of Merced began to realize that similar things might be taking place in their town. That the animals were killed quickly and cleanly, and unlike the products of a meatpacking plant, were actually thanked for their services, failed to extenuate what seemed like aberrant behavior. The result was an ordinance banning the slaughter of livestock and poultry within city limits. For most Hmong, the need to heal sick family members far outweighed the claim to a mere law, so they paid no attention, and few neighbors were nosy enough to report them. However, rumors about the sparsity of dogs and cats on Merced's south side, which had circulated sotto voce for several years, upped their volume. The rumors were false, but that did nothing to stop them. Dan Murphy told me where they had originated.
"There was a small stove fire in a Hmong house here a few years back," he said, "and one of the firemen opened the refrigerator. There was a roast pig in there. The fireman thought it was a dog, and he told his friends, and they told theirs, and instantly, people were saying that the reason there aren't so many strays around here anymore is that the Hmong are eating them all, and you better lock up your dog at night." Well, Dang Mo heard this.
Dang Mo is a local Hmong leader.
"And he went and got the fire chief and brought him over to the house and opened the refrigerator and said,
'This is a pig. Can't your men tell the difference between a pig and a dog?'
And that should have settled it. But you know, it's not as much fun to tell people about the resolution of a story as it is to tell about the genesis. So that part didn't get spread around very far."
The Hmong of Merced do not sacrifice dogs, which they know are protected by American law and custom, though some of them, like the victim of the Da of Bear Creek that Nakao told me about, may have wished that they could. They do, however, frequently sacrifice pigs and chickens, which they buy live from Hmong or American farmers. To sacrifice a cow, as the Lees did, is a rare and important event. It was the first time they had done so during their 6 years in the United States. Leah's cow cost $300, a monumental sum for a family of nine who were living on $9,480 a year plus food stamps. When I asked Nakao where the money had come from, he said, "Leah had her own money from the government." It took me a moment to understand. He had bought the sacrificial cow with 3.5 months worth of Leah's supplemental security income, a use to which federal disability assistance had probably never before been put. Because Nakao had no way of transporting a live cow to East 12th Street, he bought one from an American rancher who lived near Merced, had it slaughtered, and with the help of some of his clansmen, cut it in pieces small enough to stuff into plastic garbage bags that fit on the floor and in the trunk of his cousin's subcompact car. After they returned home, Atsineng performed the ritual chant that accompanied his journey to the realm of the unseen. During the chant, the cow's severed head was sitting on the Lees' front stoop, welcoming Leah's soul. When I asked the Lees whether any American passers-by might have been surprised by this sight, Four said,
"No, I don't think they would be surprised, because it wasn't the whole cow on the doorstep, only the head."
Nakao added,
Also, Americans would think it was okay because we had the receipt for the cow.
After the ceremonial portion of the Ning was complete, the Lees and their many invited relatives sat down and ate a large, festive meal of fried beef, boiled beef, a spicy ground beef dish called la, and a stew called guoguo. When I asked Mei Ying what guoguo was, she said, "It's made out of cow's intestines and the heart and the liver and the lungs, and you chop it up really fine, and there is a part that is what is inside the intestines, and you chop that up too. Then you boil it all up together, and you put lemongrass and herbs in it. It has a really bad name when you translate it. I guess you could call it, doo-doo soup." The literal translation of guoguo is liquid excrement. It's a classic. The celebratory mood of Leah's first few days home began to dissipate as the Lees came to feel more strongly with each passing week that the child who had been taken from them had been returned in a damaged condition. According to Mei Li, Leah had once been able to count in English and Hmong and knew all the tunes and lyrics of the traditional Hmong New Year's songs.
"Before the Americans took her away, Leah was really smart," said Nicole. "If you came in the door, she would say hello and bring a chair for you. But after those months that she was government property, I don't know what they did to her. Maybe they gave her too much medicine, or maybe she got sick because she missed us too much. Because after that, when people come, it seems she does not know them, and she could only speak a little."
The Lees were under the impression that the court had returned Leah to them because foster care had made her sicker, clear evidence that her family's care was superior. When I told Neil and Peggy this, they were surprised. They had also noted Leah's worsening developmental deficits, but in their view, her downward intellectual slide had begun before she was removed from parental custody, had been temporarily arrested by her regular drug regimen during foster care, and then been previously aggravated by the seizures she had had after her catastrophic week-long visit home in September 1985, during which her parents had failed to administer any medications. Neil and Peggy were even more surprised and grieved to learn that the Lees believed that Leah had been taken from them in the first place not to safeguard her health, but
because the doctors were angry at us
for being non-compliant and wished to inflict punishment. And when I told them that Fua and Nikau, in their willingness to travel the middle road of a little medicine and a little Ning, viewed themselves as eminently reasonable and their doctors as incapable of compromise, Neil and Peggy shook their heads in puzzlement and consternation. In order to keep Leah's condition from deteriorating further, the Lees stepped up their program of traditional medicine. I had often heard the doctors at MCMC complain that the Hmong seemed to care less than Americans did whether their sick children got better, since they spurned the hospitals as free medical care. Unbeknownst to their doctors, the Hmong actually took their children's health so seriously that they frequently budgeted large fractions of their public assistance stipends or indebted themselves to relatives in order to pay for expensive services not covered by Medi-Cal. For example, the Lees spent $1,000 on amulets filled with sacred healing herbs from Thailand, which Leah wore constantly around her neck. They also tried a host of less costly but time-consuming therapies. Fua inserted a silver coin that said 1936 Antoshin Francaise into the yolk of a boiled egg, wrapped the egg in a cloth, and rubbed Leah's body with it. When the egg turned black, that meant the sickness had been absorbed. She massaged Leah with a bowl of a spoon. She sucked the pressure out of Leah's body by pressing a small cup heated with ashes against her skin, creating a temporary vacuum as the oxygen-depleted air inside the cup cooled. She pinched Leah to draw out noxious winds. She dosed Leah with tisanes infused from the gleanings of her parking lot herb garden. Finally, she and Nikau tried changing Leah's name to Ku, a last-ditch Hmong remedy based on the premise that if a patient is called by a new name, the Da who stole her soul would be tricked into thinking that she is someone else and the soul can return. According to Fuo, this plan was foiled because Leah's doctors persisted in calling her Leah, thus ruining the subterfuge. The Li's most ambitious act of healing was taking Leah to visit a famous Tsineng in Minnesota.
"We had heard this Tsineng was very special because he can fix people and he gives good medicines," explained Nikau in the deferential tones of someone describing a distinguished specialist he has gone to great trouble and expense to consult at the Mayo Clinic. "When this Tsineng was younger, he had gotten sick himself with the same thing as Leah, where the spirit catches you and you fall down. For the Hmong people, they usually get that kind of sickness before they become a Tsineng. And maybe when Leah was grown up, that would have happened to her too, and she would be a Tsineng. This Tsineng was also a member of the Li clan, so that is why we took Leah to Minnesota." Nikau, one of his brothers, one of his grown daughters, his son-in-law, and Leah spent 3 days driving to Minnesota. "We rested one night in Salt Lake City and one night in Wyoming," said Nikau. "And then we took another day to get to Nebraska, and then we took the whole night from Nebraska to get to Minnesota. We just stopped to get gas. I only drove for 3 hours in Wyoming because Leah kept trying to hug me, so I couldn't drive, so someone else drove and I just held her." He did not remember where the Tsineng had lived, but recalled that it was several hours beyond St. Paul. "The Tsineng tied spirit strings around Leah's wrist and gave her some green medicine from roots and things like that. Some of it was boiled and you drink the juice, and some of it you boil until it crystallizes and it gets really sticky, and after it dries, you eat it." The three family members who had accompanied them stayed in Minnesota with relatives, and Nikau, again using SSI money, flew home with Leah, filled with optimism about her future well-being. "Once, I asked Bill Selvage why Merced's doctors never seemed to ask their Hmong patients how they treated their illnesses. And he replied that because the Hmong dressed at least approximately in American clothes and had driver's licenses and shopped in supermarkets, it never occurred to his colleagues, and only rarely to him, that they might practice esoteric healing arts.
If you went down to the rainforest and talked to the Yanomamo," he said, "you'd be surprised if they didn't come up with all sorts of fantastic spirit stories. You'd be surprised if they sat there and started saying, you know, 'Where is the penicillin for my impetigo?' But if you took them to this setting, the way the Hmong have come here, and you dressed them up, and they drove a car and came to MCMC, you wouldn't expect to hear those spirit stories anymore."
Neil and Peggy had no idea what the Li's were doing to heal Leah because they never thought to ask. The only American who did ask, and who therefore learned of the $1,000 amulets and at least some of the animal sacrifices, was Janine Hilt. "I would have expected the Li's to focus the most burning rays of their resentment on Janine, an official representative of the very agency that had confiscated their daughter. On the contrary, the Li's chose to categorize her not as Leah's abductor, but as her patron, the person who gave Leah her disability money. Aside from Dee Korda, Janine was the only American I talked to who didn't describe the Li's as close-mouthed and dim. Not coincidentally, she was also the only American I ever heard Fo or Nikau refer to by name. They called her Jenny. She responded by learning the names of all 8 of Leah's siblings: Chong, Zuo, Chang, Mei, Yur, True, Mai, and Peng. Compared to the Olympian doctors, Ernst and Philp, who never volunteered their first names, Janine seemed warm and unpretentious. Even her size, 5'1" and comfortably rounded, was closer to the Hmong scale. Neil and Peggy were respectively 6'2" and 5'9", and seemed even taller because they had such perfect posture. Janine also had more success keeping the lines of communication snarl-free, partly because, as a social worker, she was able to make house calls. In all their years of dealing with the Lees, Neil never visited their home and Peggy visited only once. She took the sensible step of using May, the Lees'